There's a famous scene in the basketball movie White Men Can't Jump, in which a character played by Rosie Perez describes her unconventional philosophy to her boyfriend, Billy.
You know, Billy, I got a different set of rules of mine. You want to hear them? Here they come. Sometimes when you win, you really lose. And sometimes when you lose, you really win. And sometimes when you win or lose, you actually tie. And sometimes when you tie, you actually win or lose.
And at the end of the movie, her character does more than just talk the talk. After her boyfriend ignores her threat that she'll leave if he plays one more basketball game for money, she walks the walk, turning his thrilling victory in that game into an agonizing defeat. The final chapter in Jonathan Irons' story has been heavily influenced by a basketball player who made the opposite decision, to walk away from the game at the height of her powers. It was a decision made not just to help Jonathan, but also to redefine what it means to win and lose in the criminal justice system. While the final chapter in Jonathan's story hasn't yet been completed, it's close. Hopefully, very close. And at the end of this episode, we'll let you know how you can help set Jonathan free, possibly in the next week or two.
Hi, and welcome to Undisclosed, The State versus Jonathan Irons. This is the fourth and final episode in a four-episode series about Jonathan Irons, who was arrested at age 16 for a burglary and shooting at the home of Stanley Stotler in O'Fallon, Missouri in 1997. My name is Rabia Chaudhry. I'm an attorney and author of the New York Times bestseller A Non-Story, and as always, I'm here with my colleagues Susan Simpson and Colin Miller.
Hi, this is Susan Simpson. I'm an attorney in Washington, D.C., and I blog at The View from LL2.
Hi, this is Colin Miller. I'm an associate dean and professor at the University of South Carolina School of Law, and I blog at Evidence Prof Blog.
If you've watched TV shows like Law & Order or Homicide: Life on the Streets, you've probably heard the phrase, take him to juvie, with the word juvie standing for juvenile detention, a center where minors are typically taken. But after he was arrested, 16-year-old Jonathan Irons was thrown into gin pop with grown men.
What are those first few nights and weeks and months like when you were there in jail awaiting your trial?
Terrifying and confusing. Because they didn't throw me in the juveniles. They threw me in with grown men.
Mm-hmm.
And you hear stories about what happens in jail. And I'm used to, you know, I've been to fights before, and I'm used to, you know, dealing with people my age or around my age, and, you know, people that I can get away with, you know. And some people I didn't, you know, I had this, you know, I ended up defeating this guy in a robbery attempt, and I had his gun, so I had a little sense of security, and it was like a trophy to me. So, but none of that was there. It was just me and these people, and the COs there, or jailers, you know, didn't seem to care. There were several attempts to, you know, just to take things from me, and I had to defend myself against grown men repeatedly. And I think it was because of my age and just the greenness of my conversation, because they would say things and I didn't understand what they were saying, and then people would laugh around me, like, "Oh, he didn't know, he didn't get the joke. Oh, he must be green, he must be ready. Or we can take some from him, or we can get some from him." It was people always on the take, and I felt like I was constantly in a mindset to just defend, and I found myself backing myself in corners and sitting there just not trusting anyone.
Luckily for Jonathan, after he was convicted, he was able to find a mentor of sorts.
You know, not everybody in prison is a monster. There are really good men in here. And there were men in here that, you know, that they guided me through this. And I remember this one guy telling me, he said, "Hey man, the key to your freedom is in them books. You know, don't get caught up playing happy ball and other things in prison. Don't get caught up in the prison madness. The happy ball is basketball. Don't get caught up in the prison madness. And you need to bury yourself in these books and find your freedom if you didn't do this. Other than that, I don't know what to tell you. I'm not going to do it for you." And he handed me a book, and I opened it up to a case. And I opened it up. It was Sloop versus D'Lo. I don't know if I'm pronouncing announcer and the writer, you sloop a slup for a sloppy deal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I remember trying to read it, and I just could not understand it. I fell asleep. I woke up with drool on my shirt and on the pages of the book. It was just too much. It was like, man, what is going on? I don't get it. And I was too ashamed to ask questions.
In other words, Jonathan ended up facing some of the same roadblocks that led to him to drop out of high school. But this time, when he hit the wall, he kept pounding until it fell down.
I went to the library every chance I got. I even sneaked to the library. You know, some people would sneak to recreation to get extra recreational period, but I used to sneak to the law library. And I would literally stay in the law library from 8 in the morning to 8 p.m. at night. And the librarian finally one day came up to me and said, hey, you spent all this time skating in this library. I was like, yeah, I know. I looked at it with like this shock look on my face, like, oh man, I'm in trouble. She said, yeah, I know what you've been doing. I see you. So why don't you just get a job up here? You want a job? I was like, yeah. And I got a job, and I was in the library from like 7, no, sometimes 10 months to 10 at night, just pouring through books and reading cases and going to the Leisure Library and, you know, and reading different literature and just improving my ability to read and write and type and use computers. And Maya's godfather and godmother was able to, years later, they bought an education course for me from Blackstone Career Institute, a paralegal course, and I took that and I finished that with distinction. Like, oh, I just kept building onto it, and I started helping other prisoners with their cases and getting some relief for some of them.
But while Jonathan was helping some of his fellow inmates win their appeals, he kept losing his.
And so, again, yeah, I mean, you're doing this work, you're helping other people in the prison, you're being commended by people at law schools, and yet for years, your own appeals are not successful. Is there a point at which you fall into despair, or are you just consistently fighting, knowing I'm going to eventually one day get out?
Yeah, I just continue to keep fighting, but I knew what the law said. And I knew at some point, I know that everybody in the criminal justice system, police officers and prosecutors included, are not evil and bad and bent on violating people's rights. So I knew at some point, I just had faith, and God kept encouraging me that my case was going to get in front of somebody. I'm going to have the help that I need, and I'm going to be home. It may not be today, it may not be tomorrow, but it may be in the future. Then other people will come along and encourage me. Just to keep going, not to give up. Or I'd see a case that was promising, or I find out about something that's under review that was promising, and I just continue to go. But don't get me wrong. After every appeal, I felt like a boa, a python was around my throat, and every time I lost an appeal, his grip got tighter on me, to the point where, you know, I felt like, man, you know, this hate here is like, this is my last hope. You know, I'm going to try it. This is my last hope. But it hurt. Every appeal that I lost hurt. And, you know, I was depressed, you know, for a period of time after each one, because I put so much hope and stock into each one. And just, you know, I planned and lived my life with the mindset of, when I get out, not if I get out, but when I get out and go home. But each one was a setback, and then, you know, rather than just living in the defeat, I managed to, you know, to get myself back up and keep going. Yeah, but I had, there's been days where I just, after losing or, you know, something like that happened, where I wouldn't come out of myself for a couple of days and just would cry and just like, man, where do I go now? Just from all of the emotions poured into, you know, doing legal work and, you know, knowing what the law says. Like, how is it, questioning, how is it that the law says this, but yet they just completely ignore what the law says and write what they want to write?
Mm-hmm.
It's like, this is just ridiculous. But, you know, I knew it. At some point, somebody's going to say, you're right. Go home, man. This was wrong.
Luckily, Jonathan didn't have to go it alone. Like the law librarian, Sherilyn and Reggie Williams, whom we introduced you to last episode, saw something in him. Something that would lead to them fighting to prove his innocence for over a decade.
So Sherilyn, yeah, I'll start with you. What is it about Jonathan as a person and his case that both drew you in to work on it initially and then kept you over all these years fighting to prove his innocence?
First of all, we have three sons, and the fact that you could, as a parent, you know, Jonathan was picked up and interrogated without a guardian being present. He was smart enough to ask for an attorney, and they didn't provide one for him. Just the thought that that could have been one of our kids, that to think that you could be at home and your child could be in a police station being interrogated, it just was a very eye-opening thing for me. But also, more importantly, Jonathan's character and his personality. I mean, with us being parents of boys, even though Jonathan was 25 when we met him, when we began to get to know him, we could just see that he really could see his heart and that he was very intelligent and he just needed nurturing and love, and he had a lot of potential there that we could see. It's just, he just needed love, and his personality is, he's the kind of person that he's very caring and thoughtful of others, you know, totally different than what most people would imagine getting to know someone in his situation. You wouldn't expect him to be a gracious, caring, and giving type of person, but that's what he is. And so once we got to know him and he became family to us, we wanted to do everything we could to help him.
And as Sherilyn notes, it was the same indomitable spirit Jonathan recognized in himself that allowed her husband and her to push through defeat after defeat.
There were a lot of times over those 14 years or so that we were just exhausted of the process, because it's so discouraging sometimes when, you know, you get denied, denial after not denial. But it was really Jonathan's persistence. He would bounce back. You know, we'd be devastated as a result of something that we submitted in court, and we'd just be devastated. And Jonathan would have a few days where he'd be down, and then he would encourage us, and his attitude would just encourage us to keep going. But, you know, honestly, it would become exhausting and very disappointing at times. But because of Jonathan, we kept going.
Meanwhile, Reggie echoes Sherilyn with a similar sentiment.
For me, it was all about, you know, if this could happen to him, this could probably happen to anybody. But as I got to know him as a person, it just made it even stronger that I was going to do everything that I could do to help him out.
And those years of help finally paid off. One of the biggest losses for Jonathan at his trial was a statement he made during booking. Last episode, we noted that Detective Handlin bypassed booking Jonathan for a one-on-one interview that he claimed produced a confession. A confession that Jonathan vehemently denies making. But after this interview, Jonathan was booked, and he doesn't deny making a statement that the booking officer, Detective Stringer, says he made. Detective Stringer would testify as follows at trial.
What did he ask you?
First he said, "Can I ask you a question?" And I said, "What?" And he said, "Did they find any of my fingerprints in that guy's house?" I said I didn't know, and I wasn't handling that portion of the investigation.
Now, you might guess about how the prosecution used this statement at trial, right? You might think that the prosecutor used the statement as evidence that Jonathan knew he had been in Stanley Stotler's house and could have left behind fingerprints. And so, he was asking Detective Stringer whether they had found any of his fingerprints in Stotler's house, because that would have meant that the jig was up. Except that's not what happened. It's weirder than that. You'll recall from episode 1 that the burglar broke into Stanley Stotler's basement after smashing a window, and there's no way that window could have been a point of exit. Indeed, the police ruled out every point of exit except the front storm door, which they were 100% convinced was the point of exit for the burglar. The O'Fallon police were able to lift 3 latent fingerprints from the interior storm door, right around the handle you would use to open the door. During discovery, the state would turn over a police report that made it look like all 3 prints were matches for Stanley Stotler, and the deputy sheriff who lifted the prints would testify as follows at trial.
Were you able to get any what we call usable prints?
Yes, sir. There were identifiable prints obtained from the residence.
Who were they identified as being the prince of?
As the prince of the victim.
Were you able to get any other usable prints out of that building?
No, sir, we were not.
So how did the state get around the fact that Jonathan Iron's prints were not on the burglar's obvious point of exit from Stotler's house? Well, with regard to the lack of fingerprints on the storm door, the prosecutor argued as follows during closing.
Miss Sullivan asked you to take that as evidence that he is not guilty. Again, reiterate, it doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure out you can wear two gloves. You are not going to find fingerprints. Remember Bill Stringer up here? Can I ask you something when he is booking him? Did you get any of my fingerprints in there? He knows about fingerprints. Did they get my fingerprints out of there?
Yes, that's right. The prosecutor's argument was not that Jonathan Irons was worried that he'd left behind fingerprints at Stotler's house, but that he had the foresight to wear gloves, knew that he hadn't left any fingerprints behind, and was mocking the booking officer. Jonathan, of course, characterizes his comment very differently.
Back to the day of your arrest, after you speak to Hanlon, you're being processed, and there's sort of this disputed issue at trial where you're asking about the fingerprints, and they sort of portray it a certain way, and you say, I didn't mean it that way. What do you recall about the comment you made about whether your fingerprints might be in Stotler's house?
Well, the guy was processing my fingerprints, and I'm sitting there thinking this whole time, this has got to be a mistake or some type of joke. Like, there's no way that I could have done this. And I'm sitting there racking my brain, like, did I do this? Was I high drunk? I was like, hold on. I said, man, no. And so I look at this guy doing my fingerprints. So I'm like, man, you wasting your time. This is what I'm thinking in my mind. I say sarcastically, hey. He said, what's up? I said, did you find my fingerprints in the guy's house? And he says, I don't know. All my job is to take your fingerprints, bag and tag it, and put you in the cell. I'm like, okay, whatever. And that's just with attitude and sarcasm. It's just ridiculous.
But for the prosecutor, the ridiculous became the sublime, as he pushed the theory that the cover-up was worse than the crime. The prosecutor would end his closing argument with his theory of Jonathan Irons as a criminal mastermind and use it to argue for a 70-year sentence. Years later, it would turn out that there was a cover-up, but it wasn't by Jonathan Irons. It was by the state. I talked with Reggie Williams about a discovery that he made in the case. And so you can take me through how you were able to discover that fingerprint report and what your reaction was when you found it.
Well, by the time that came around, we had a pro bono lawyer, and Sherry and I had gathered enough money to hire an investigator, and we also had the help of a law student. And so we got permission because we wanted to see that. I really wanted to see the evidence. I had read the transcript. I had read every piece of paper that was in his file, and you know, for me, I needed to see what was out there. And so the lawyer got us permission through the governor's office to go to the police station and have the opportunity to look at the evidence that was in their custody at the time.
And one of those pieces of evidence related to the fingerprints that were at the heart of the state's case against Jonathan Irons. And when you see this fingerprint report, what jumps out to you about this fingerprint report versus other versions that you had seen previously?
You know, it was kind of interesting because we asked to see the file, and when we got there, they would not let us see the file. So they let me see some particular evidence, like what he was wearing that day, and the bag that they collected and all that. But when it came to the files, they weren't going to let us do that. But I think I forgot what her name was, but she was the record keeper. She brought me a blue manila envelope, a folder, and then she said that she made copies of what they had, and she gave it to me. And so I started looking through it, and by then I was familiar with everything that he had in the public defender's box.
Mm-hmm.
And so as I looked through it, you know, a lot of the stuff I had seen before. And then I came across the latent fingerprint, and as soon as I saw it, I was like, I have never seen this before. This is different. And so I went over to the law student, kind of said, hey, I saw something different in here. But I didn't want to say it while we were there, so I just closed the folder and said, we need to take this back and, you know, show it to the lawyer.
This new fingerprint report that had never been disclosed to the defense had a difference from the report disclosed at trial. A key difference.
And the big difference you saw is, you know, what the defense was shown at trial and what the jurors were told is this storm door almost certainly is the point of exit for the burglar, and they were led to believe any fingerprints recovered belonged to the homeowner, Stanley Stotler, whereas this new fingerprint report that you found said what?
It was very similar to the one that I had seen in the public defender's box, except it had an extra box where one of the fingerprints was considered identifiable to the victim. And that was not what I saw in her box, and that is not what I saw that was entered into evidence during the trial.
Breaking that down, both the fingerprint report and the testimony presented at trial to the jurors made it look like all three fingerprints lifted from the storm door were a match for homeowner Stanley Stotler. But with this different version of the fingerprint report, with a new box revealed, was that only two of the three fingerprints were a match for Stanley Stotler. The third fingerprint was not a match for Stanley Stotler or Jonathan Irons. Instead, it almost certainly came from the burglar, especially given that Stanley Stotler lived alone. You know, at trial, the evidence is presented. We know the perpetrator left through this storm door. We recovered these fingerprints, and it's construed to the jury to say all the fingerprints belong to Stotler, who, of course, lives in the house. What do you recall when you first learned about this other version of the fingerprint report, which turned out that this story wasn't true?
I was in disbelief. You're talking about when we got the new form, right?
When you got the form saying, right, that there are these unidentified fingerprints that didn't belong to you or Stotler.
Yeah, I was in disbelief and didn't know what to think of it, and I read it probably 100 times. Did this guy, and you, even being a criminal defendant, you want to believe that police are telling the truth. And you, there's a tendency to just automatically assume, like, oh, well, you know, he said it. It must be the case. Like, there was nothing for me to indicate otherwise. But when I saw that, and the more I read it, the more I understand it, I was just so overwhelmed that finally, here's the truth. Here is proof that someone else has done this. It's not just me saying, hey, man, you know, my fingerprints weren't there. I get to say now, no, not only were my fingerprints weren't there, there's evidence that someone else was there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's significant. And then I went to the library and again, you know, continued to research it and find out. I found cases that supported the direction that my case is taking today. And I was so thankful, and I praised God about it, and I was saying hallelujah, and, you know, and I was thankful to, you know, my people who found it. Reggie Williams was the one that found it. He found it with an investigator and a law student. The investigator was Robert Swapshire, who's passed away, and Rick Kroger, who's now a lawyer in Illinois.
But while this discovery was a revelation in terms of proving Jonathan's innocence, his prior appeals had erected another wall that he would need to break through. He rightfully predicted that the state would fight tooth and nail to argue that any new claims were procedurally barred, and so he needed someone to champion his case not only in the court of law, but also in the court of public opinion. And luckily for Jonathan, he had a literal champion in his corner, Maya Moore. Maya Moore is a 2-time NCAA champion at UConn, a 2-time gold medalist, and a 4-time WNBA champion with the Minnesota Lynx, including winning the title in both 2017 and 2015, the latter due in large part to a clutch 3-pointer she hit at the end of Game 3 of the WNBA Finals.
Tie game, 1.7 to go in the fourth. Whalen to trigger in. Gets it to Moore. Moore will get it off. The shot is good! Game 3 belongs to Moore!
Maya Moore is also the goddaughter of Sherilyn and Reggie Williams, who themselves were introduced to the case by Maya's great-uncle, an employee at the prison known as The Walls.
My godparents had known Jonathan for a couple of years at that point before I met him. And my godparents got to know Jonathan because of my great-uncle, who was my godmom's dad. So my great-uncle, Hugh Flowers, had been doing prison ministry through a choir program for years at the Missouri State Penitentiary, which is used to be called The Walls, which is where Jonathan went initially at the age of 18. And then the Jefferson City Correctional Center later opened in 2004. And so my great-uncle was volunteering there through the choir program, and that's how he met Jonathan and just saw potential in him and just took an interest in just kind of mentoring him. And Jonathan wanted to learn and started to learn, like, oh, I can sing. And my great-uncle kind of basically challenged him to be a leader. And so over time, Jonathan eventually became a leader and became the leader of that choir. And he just kind of got folded into our family. And so my great-uncle encouraged my godparents to reach out to Jonathan because he had just lost his grandmother around 2005. Mm-hmm. And so he was in a really low place, just, you know, not having a lot of family support. And so my godparents reached out to him. You know, they were kind of like, okay, you know, if my great-uncle, who I call Papa, you know, Papa wants, you know, us to reach out, and we'll reach out. And so it didn't take long for my godparents to fall in love with Jonathan and for Jonathan to kind of eventually let them in, you know, and trusting them in his life. And then them learning about his case and learning about, you know, just getting to know him as a person and just a real familial bond.
It was that familial bond that led to Maya becoming involved in Jonathan's case.
My mom and I ended up getting into a routine of coming back every other summer to spend time with my family in Missouri. And one of those trips back, when I was around age 18, I might have just been turning 18, that's when I had my eyes opened to the reality of what goes on in the criminal justice system, because my godparents, Reggie and Sherry, had Jonathan's case, and they had all these papers spread over the table at the home we were taking a vacation in. And I asked them, what are all these papers? And, you know, they were explaining to me about Jonathan's situation. And my mind was blown, because I think, in general, growing up, I assumed if someone was in prison, it was because they were supposed to be. And so I was just really mind blown of how this 16-year-old, at the time, he was 16, just a couple years younger than the age I was when I discovered his case, how that could happen to him. And just all the different pieces of evidence and discrepancies and things that didn't make sense of how he was put away. I was shocked, and so I was interested, and I wanted to stay up to date, and I wanted to hear about how things were going with him, because I just felt bad, just as a human being, hearing about another human being's experience being wrongfully convicted.
But eventually, being updated on Jonathan's case was not enough. In February 2019, Maya Moore issued a statement through Lynx coach and general manager Cheryl Reeve that she would be taking a sabbatical from the Lynx in 2019. In part, the statement said, quote, as she recently shared, Maya has expressed a need to shift her attention more fully to family and ministry dreams in a way that she has been unable to as a professional basketball player. Maya's decision was initially reported in local news stations like KARE 11.
And this is different than an injury. This is different than rumors about wanting to play something else. This is something that is unique to Maya Moore, and as much a part of her as anything, and most would argue this is the central key to her, is her faith.
Absolutely.
And she is saying, I have to put that in the driver's seat. I've never seen anything like it in professional athletics.
It's pretty outstanding. And knowing Maya in just the small scope that I do, I think that she will be an absolute champion in this as well. She is golden in everything she touches.
And soon, as it became clear that one of the big projects Maya was working on during her sabbatical was to clear the name of Jonathan Irons, that news became national, such as this piece on NBC Nightly News.
There's no stopping Maya Moore. 4 WNBA titles, 2 Olympic golds, dubbed the greatest winner in the history of the women's game.
So My urge is to go find a ball.
But now she's putting down the ball indefinitely, stepping away to answer another call.
Was it hard to walk away?
It's hard, but when your convictions are moving you to a place that you know is right, it makes it a little less hard.
That new place, fighting what she calls wrongful convictions.
This call is from a correctional facility.
On the line, Jonathan Irons. Arrested at 16, he was sentenced to 50 years for a non-fatal shooting. He's entering year 23.
I'm not guilty of this.
The more Maya investigated his case, the more she agreed.
There was no physical evidence, no DNA, footprint, fingerprint. That began a journey for me of having my eyes open to, oh my gosh, people are in prison who shouldn't be there.
So Maya shifted her game, now focusing on things that matter most to her, like freeing Jonathan.
She's at the top of the mountain and taking a break to help me. That's so encouraging.
We're almost at 40,000 signatures.
What?
When I give Jonathan a voice, so many other people get a voice.
This philosophy espoused by Maya is consistent with a statement that Maya herself released about her sabbatical. It was about redefining what it means to win. In pertinent part, that statement read,
"There are different ways to measure success. The success that I've been a part of in basketball truly blows my mind every time I think about it. But the main way I measure success in life is something I don't often get to emphasize explicitly through pro ball. I measure success by asking, am I living out my purpose?"
And for Maya, part of her purpose was proving Jonathan's innocence. To achieve that purpose, she's worked on his case, promoted it in the media, and helped to pay for a legal team that could overcome the procedural bars that could prevent him from proving his innocence.
One of those procedural bars takes us full circle to the very first case that Jonathan read. Many of Jonathan's best claims related to ineffective assistance of counsel based on the failure of his trial attorney to do things like contact and call Amber Beckman as an alibi witness and object to the admission of the informant gun. But those claims were barred by prior appeals. Except for the fact that there is that case that Jonathan randomly flipped to at the start of his legal journey.
I remember this one guy telling me, he said, "Hey man, the key to your freedom is in them books." And he handed me a book. And I opened it up to a case, and I opened it up. It was Sloop versus D'Lo, and I remember trying to read it, and I just could not understand it. I fell asleep. I woke up with drool on my shirt and on the pages of the book. It was just too much. It was like, man, what is going? I don't get it.
But while Jonathan didn't get it at the time, his mentor was right. That book and that specific case to which Jonathan had flipped quite possibly held the key to his freedom. Schlepp v. D'Lo states that claims that are procedurally barred because they could have been raised earlier can be bootstrapped to evidence of actual innocence to get back into court. And so this is the case that Jonathan's attorneys would rely on to use the undisclosed fingerprint report to get all of Jonathan's claims to an evidentiary hearing last October. Here's reporting on that hearing from local TV station KOMU.
"We just spoke to Maya Moore about 30 minutes ago here at the Cole County Courthouse. She's here at the Cole County Courthouse in hopes of helping Jonathan Irons. He says he was wrongly convicted of his crimes back in 1997. Today, the judge decided fingerprinting evidence from the case needs to be reevaluated. 5 different witnesses spoke in court today, including Irons himself. Petitioners fighting for his release argued a lack of physical evidence and even police misconduct."
That misconduct was not just the misconduct by Detective Michael Hanlon that we discussed last episode. It was misconduct in connection with the fingerprint report. Jonathan's team alleged not just that the state accidentally failed to turn over the exculpatory version of the fingerprint report. They claimed it was a cover-up. And they weren't alone. The state, the respondent at the hearing, agreed that there was bad faith and quite possibly a literal cover-up. Judge Daniel Green, who presided over the hearing, would issue an opinion this March. With regard to the fingerprint report, Judge Green observed that,
"As agreed upon at the October hearing by petitioner's counsel, witnesses, and respondent, These two reports, i.e. the one shown at trial and the one later found by Reggie Williams, have identical markings and undoubtedly originated from the same document. It was suggested by both petitioner's counsel and respondent that someone intentionally covered up the exculpatory box, as well as the missing signature line, at the bottom of the report with paper before making a copy of this document. It was clear that this trial exhibit had been altered to omit the information on the original report that was exculpatory. At the October 9th, 2019 hearing, respondent conceded that the document had been clearly altered. The existence of this doctored report strongly suggests that the original disclosed report was altered by someone involved in the prosecution or investigation before it was disclosed to the defense in the discovery process.
This then led to an easy finding by Judge Green. Because the fingerprints were at the heart of the case against Jonathan Irons, and because this new report strongly suggested that someone else shot Stanley Stotler, the state had committed a Brady violation. In other words, the state had failed to disclose material exculpatory evidence that undermined any confidence the judge could have had in the jury's verdict. And because of this threshold finding, Judge Green could also consider the other evidence that we've discussed in the series.
First, Judge Green found that the combination of the fingerprint report and the uncovered evidence of Detective Hanlon's egregious misconduct, quote, removes any doubt that the verdict in this case is not worthy of confidence. Second, with regard to the biased photo array, Stanley Stotler's initial inability to identify Jonathan, and Stotler's subsequent identification after being left with the police reports, Judge Green held that Dr. Lampinen's testimony highlighted many of the problems with the identification procedures in this case, and in the court's mind, has raised significant doubts whether petitioner was mistakenly identified due to the suggestive procedures utilized in this case during the photo lineup and the unusual series of events that culminated in the positive identifications of petitioner by Mr. Stotler in later court proceedings. Third, Judge Green held that, quote, the case against Irons would have been significantly weaker if it had been established at trial that the gun introduced into evidence had no connection either to the offense or Irons, and probably should not have been admitted into evidence under settled case law. Fourth and finally, the court found that the statement by Amber Beckman, the Bible study alibi witness, quote, indicates that it would have been logistically difficult, if not impossible, for Irons to have committed this crime, given the timeline provided and the distances involved between the Beckman house and Mr. Stotler's house. In other words, there was now no confidence in the evidence pointing to Jonathan Irons' guilt and significant confidence in evidence pointing to his innocence. And so, Judge Green granted Jonathan a conditional writ of habeas corpus and vacated his convictions, with Maya Moore sharing her bird's eye view of the day on her website Win With Justice.
They overturned it, y'all. They overturned the case, man. Judge Green did it, man.
I have had a chance to review all the pleadings and the evidence taken in the case. This court will issue a judgment granting petitioner a conditional writ of habeas corpus in order that his convictions be vacated and the petitioner be discharged from custody.
I just witnessed Jonathan Irons' conviction being overturned by Judge Green in the Cole County Courthouse in Jefferson City, Missouri.
After 23 years.
23 years.
23 years of lies. I'm free.
Thank you, everybody who signed the change.org petition. It's just an amazing day here, and hopefully really, really soon we can see Jonathan walk out of those doors.
Praise the Lord. Hallelujah. I'm free. Hallelujah.
Woo!
As Judge Green noted, however, his grant of relief to Jonathan was conditional, and this takes us full circle to the beginning of the episode, as well as the goal of Maya's organization, Win With Justice. Specifically, Win With Justice is a social action campaign that asks everyone, and specifically prosecutors, to redefine how we look at wins and losses in the criminal justice system.
The more I dug into the culture of prosecutors' offices, and again, every prosecutor isn't corrupt. Every conviction isn't a wrongful conviction. But it happens more than we want to talk about. And the mindset, I get it, as a competitor, a mindset a prosecutor can come into a situation is can you know, there's a sense of pride and kind of competitiveness. And, you know, there's political elements that are there that can compete with the true spirit of what the heart of the prosecutor is supposed to be about. And so making sure we are really looking honestly at the culture and the language and the way we look at convictions and how well a prosecutor is doing and how we're measuring that. And by simply just looking at how many convictions they have, I think we're doing ourselves a disservice as a nation, as a state, as a community, because convictions don't necessarily reflect justice. We need to actually look at what is the right thing in each case. When you're looking at people as human beings, as someone's daughter, someone's son, someone's dad, someone's uncle, and what is the proper, you know, what is the proper move? Because prosecutors, I've learned, they really are the most powerful actors in our justice system. They set the charges. You know, they are basically responsible for how we move through someone's trial. And so, you know, to make sure that we are judging success in our prosecutors' offices by more than just convictions, I think is huge. And as I've learned over the last 3 or 4 years, as I've had my eyes open to what's going on, and I've learned that there are prosecutors all over the country who are doing this well, mm-hmm. and who are changing things, and who are actually, you look at a situation and it's messy and it's hard, and you have to have wisdom and you have to have, you know, balance and fairness and try to look at all the angles, and it's hard work, but people are doing it and they're making a difference, and families are being restored and not destroyed.
Unfortunately, this type of progressive prosecution has not been seen in Jonathan's case. As we noted, the state itself concluded that the fingerprint that largely exonerated Jonathan had been clearly altered by someone who worked for the state. And so, the state attorney general's office could have, and should have, dropped any appeals of Judge Green's ruling, especially in light of COVID-19 spreading like wildfire in Jonathan's prison. Instead, at every stage of possible appeal, the AG's office has delayed until the last day before submitting a filing to keep its appeal alive. An appeal not rooted in facts, but instead in the same procedural red tape Jonathan's team cut through with the undisclosed fingerprint report. But the AG's office is almost out of appeals, and that could mean that Jonathan will become a free man after spending almost 60% of his life behind bars.
And if, God willing, everything holds up and the state does not take this to trial again and you're released, what are your plans, goals, hopes, aspirations for what you want to do and who you want to be after you're released?
I want to be an encourager, and I want to, you know, whatever, you know, that looks like. I want to help people. I want to help people that are similarly situated, and I want to help people in the fight for criminal justice reform. I want to do ministry. I want to share my story and my faith, and, you know, and how I made it through these circumstances with other people. And whatever else, you know, God puts in my heart. I want to live life, you know, but not in a way to try to make up for, you know, the time that was wrongfully taken from me, but in a way, it's like, you know, I still got a lot of life left. I'm going to enjoy life. I want to be there for, you know, for the people who have been there for me through all of this. I want to speak. I want to travel. I want to get married. I want to have kids. I want to live.
And as we noted at the top of the episode, there's a way you can hopefully help Jonathan achieve his dreams. This episode is premiering on June 29th, 2020. The Supreme Court of Missouri is scheduled to rule on whether to hear the state attorney general's final appeal on July 1st. There are no guarantees, but we feel pretty good that the court will decline to take up the case. If that happens, St. Charles prosecutor Tim Lomar will then have 10 days to decide whether to force Jonathan and his family to endure another trial or drop the case for good. We want to front-end things and make sure that Tim Lomar hears all of your voices. Tim Lomar's phone number is 636-949-7355. Let me repeat that. It's 636-949-7355. And his email address is pa@sccmo.org. Once again, that's pa@sccmo.org. With the blessing of Jonathan's legal team, we are asking you to call and email Tim Lomar to respectfully let him know that there is no integrity in the case against Jonathan Irons, and that a win would be dropping the case against Jonathan based upon shrinking evidence of his guilt and the growing evidence of his innocence.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Undisclosed. I'd like to thank the following people: Rebecca Lavoie for audio production, Christy Williams for website management, Mital Telhan, our executive producer. As always, I'd like to thank our sponsors. You can support us at patreon.com/undisclosedpod, and you can follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram using the handle @undisclosedpod.